This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It seemed like a far-fetched prospect in 2006 when my guest David Plouffe and his partner David Axelrod had their first meeting with Barack Obama about running for president. Plouffe became Obama's chief campaign manager, Axelrod the chief strategist. In Plouffe's new memoir, The Audacity to Win, he says that last November he had a hard time actually believing they'd won. And Axelrod said, "It's too big to comprehend." Plouffe writes, "We had just elected the President of the United States, an African-American man born to a Kenyan father and a Kansan mother, just 4 years out of the Illinois State Senate." How they won is the subject of the memoir. Earlier in Plouffe's career, he managed two U.S. Senate races, a congressional race, and was the executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. In 2004, he became a partner at AKPD Message and Media, the firm founded by David Axelrod. Axelrod is now Obama's senior advisor. Plouffe is not serving in the administration. David Plouffe, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you'd worked on Obama's 2004 Senate campaign. When he told you that he was considering running for president, did you honestly think he was ready?
First of all, we weren't sure he would run. I mean, you know, most people plan to run for president for years, in some cases decades. And so, you know, he jumped into this in a very unorthodox way. And I think both David Axelrod and I thought that he'd probably end up not running when we first began to discuss it. But as it became clear that he was more serious and this may happen, I think I began to really feel confident that he had the potential to be a terrific president. I wasn't sure he had the potential to be a great candidate.
Why not?
Because he had never campaigned across the country, had never really been in a tough election where he had attacks against him. And there are similarities, obviously, between a good candidate and a good president, but they also have quite some important distinctions. And so I think that was the outstanding question is, could he adapt to the rigors of this? And, you know, we obviously had some fits and starts, but, you know, he ended up being one of the best presidential candidates to grace that stage, certainly in a generation.
Now, you write that early on in the campaign, you told Obama that he had to let go and trust the staff, that the staff will inevitably screw up, but the most precious resource in any campaign is the candidate's time. So Obama couldn't also be the campaign manager and the scheduler and the driver. And Obama said, "I understand that intellectually, but this is my life and career, and I think I could probably do every job on the campaign better than the people I'll hire to do it." And you say, "This was my first exposure to Obama's significant self-confidence." Did you think of it at the time as significant self-confidence or arrogance?
No, but it's interesting. That actually conversation is from 2003. So this is when he's in his Senate race. So think about that conversation. I mean, we're basically talking about You got to stop driving yourself. You got to let someone else keep your schedule. And, you know, 5.5 short years later, he's been elected president. I mean, it's a remarkable trajectory. So, no, I did not think it was arrogance. I just think it was someone who had been, you know, in state Senate races. He had run for Congress once and lost. So, you know, he had done most things by himself. And now he was running for statewide office. And so he had to learn to give up a little bit. And that's fairly common in candidates. You know, we all like to control our time, right? And to give that up is a pretty big sacrifice. But it's the only way you can really run a campaign.
You write that you had done zero research on your own candidate, violating a central rule of politics, know more about yourself than your opponents and the media do. Were you referring to Obama's Senate race or to the presidential race when you wrote that?
In the presidential race. There was some research done in the Senate race, although you have to remember that he ended up not having a competitive general election in 2004 in the Senate race because his opponent had to drop out. So, and he ended up running against Alan Keyes in what was a cakewalk. So, and because he had not been preparing to run for president, if he had been preparing to run for president in 2006 and 2007, you know, we would have had people doing research. But that was a casualty of kind of how we got into this, which was very last minute, without a lot of planning. And so that made the entry into the campaign difficult because we were having to deal with things like, you know, making sure computers worked and we had a website and we got staff on the ground in Iowa and places like that. But we were also getting a lot of inquiries about his life and we didn't have all the answers. So that was a really torturous period because every day, you know, we'd get inquiries that we didn't have the answers to.
What should you have known that you didn't know about Barack Obama when you started running his presidential campaign?
Well, I think, again, it was less a sin of commission than just a circumstance. So, you know, the kind of things you want is you want to evaluate, obviously, every vote he cast in Illinois and in Washington and all the campaign contributions and all the statements that have made. And, you know, we didn't have all that. We had to gather all that in many respects. So it made it difficult.
You got blindsided by Reverend Wright twice during the presidential campaign. The first time was just before he was scheduled to give the invocation when Barack Obama was announcing that he would run for president. And a Rolling Stone piece was just published in which what were some of the things Wright was quoted as saying in that you found upsetting?
Well, there was many. I actually right now can't recall the exact language, but it was, you know, very inflammatory. It was along the lines of the type of thing that we would see later in 08 popping up all over the Internet and all over cable TV.
Well, let me quote what you say in the book that you found most disturbing. Reverend Wright said, "We are deeply involved in the importing of drugs, the exporting of guns, and the training of professional killers. We believe in white supremacy and black inferiority and believe it more than we believe in God. We conducted radiation experiments on our own people. We cared nothing about human life if the ends justify the means." So after reading those quotes in Rolling Stone, you and Barack Obama and the team decided that Reverend Wright should not give the invocation. He should just do a kind of quiet prayer backstage behind the scenes with Obama and his family. And you write, but you still didn't investigate him more. What do you think, in retrospect, you should have done to find out more about Reverend Wright and about how statements that he was making or had made might affect the campaign?
Well, I think we should have gone through and looked at every sermon, every statement he had ever made. And, you know, we did not do that. We looked at some of them.
How come you didn't do that? Did you think, well, this was just an aberration or people were blowing it out of proportion? Why didn't you look more?
Well, I think we thought, you know, what Barack Obama had said previously about this was obviously we all have pastors and priests and people who say things we don't agree with. And, you know, his relationship with that church community was quite strong. And, you know, it was much more about the church community. They do remarkable service work and mentoring work than any one individual. So I think that we thought that would be raised and that would be how it would be answered. But I think that we should have gone through everything ever said. It was kind of a breakdown. We thought some of it was being done by our research department, and it was, but not as thoroughly. A group of us at a more senior level should have, you know, demanded to look at all the videos of the, you know, inflammatory language so that we could gauge its, whether it would be a destructive impact or not. And we didn't do that. And so we weren't caught off guard that Wright had said inflammatory things. It's just, you know, some of those tapes, when they emerged on ABC and Fox News and then blew up all over the Internet, that was the first time we had seen those videos. And that was really unforgivable. And in that respect, you know, we certainly let our candidate down. And, you know, the other thing is just to, you know, think through, obviously he eventually, separated from Wright and the church. And, you know, we really never had that discussion about whether he should do that. Now, most of the time in the campaign, he was, you know, attending church services in Iowa, New Hampshire, and other places, not at Trinity. But so it was really a breakdown and something that, was very searing because it wasn't just that, you know, we were going through a tough time. That's always hard enough. But when you deserve some blame for what's happening, it makes it even tougher.
The statements that Reverend Wright had made and the controversy that surrounded them and the hit that Obama was taking as a result of it led to his speech about race, which I think most people would agree was a kind of groundbreaking speech that really reach people, you know, in an emotional way. And from what you write, it sounds like Obama had been wanting to give a speech about race, but that you and David Axelrod discouraged him from doing it until the Wright episode. Why did you discourage him from giving a speech about race?
Well, it wasn't something he had a great urgency about. He had just raised whether or not, you know, it would make some sense, you know, given his candidacy. And we explained, listen, what, you know, people are focused on is who's going to end the war in Iraq and who's going to create jobs for the middle class and finally get health care done. And, you know, it's tough enough to reach people with messages. If you're offering them too many of them, you're not going to be effective. And he agreed with that. And what we saw in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina is I think there was some notion in the beginning of the campaign, you know, would he be able to attract support from white voters? And, you know, we saw in Illinois he did, but our view was, listen, he either will or he won't. We had confidence he would, but not much we can do about it. So when it came to the right thing, I mean, this is a remarkable leadership moment. You know, the political playbook certainly does not suggest that you elevate an issue like right. You know, what you try and do is do some interviews and hope it goes away. And what he said is, no, I need to give a speech about this and put it in larger context. So that guaranteed that Reverend Wright would be the dominant issue in the campaign for a long period of time. And this was something that, you know, we didn't do any polling on. You know, we didn't do a lot of consultation on. This was Barack Obama's desire and his gut. He obviously ended up writing that speech. And, you know, it was a remarkable moment. And we didn't know how it was going to turn out. But I'll never forget him saying, you know, maybe people won't accept this speech and they won't expect my explanation. But, you know, that's fine. What's important is that I tell the American people what I believe about this, try and talk about this in some context. Maybe this can be an educational moment. And so what we saw after the Wright speech was there were still plenty of voters who were concerned about it, obviously. But they all, for the most part, thought that he had handled it like they'd like a leader to, and like few politicians these days seem to. So it was a wonderful, I think, insight into him. Without that, you know, I think we probably would have gone on to be the Democratic nominee, but we would have been probably more weakened than we were.
When John Edwards was ready to drop out of the race, he offered to make a deal with the Obama campaign. You know, he'll drop out, but he expected something in return. But he also made it clear that he'd go with Hillary Clinton if she made a better deal. Give us a sense of what happened behind the scenes.
Well, this was a conversation with someone who had been a senior member of his campaign team. So whether this person got ahead of Edwards or not, I can't really speak to. But what the representation was that, you know, he may get out. If he gets out, you know, he'd like to understand what arrangements could be made for the future. And, you know, what we said was, listen, Senator, we love your support, but, you know, we're obviously not going to be locked into any commitments. And you know, I think when President Obama talked to Senator Edwards, the conversation wasn't quite as direct as the one I had with his representation. And our belief was that, you know, even though we were in a fierce contest with Senator Clinton at the time, you know, she, having gone through 8 years of the Clinton administration, knew better than most that you can't make these kind of premature decisions about personnel in an administration. So we thought at the end of the day it was a fairly bizarre moment that you know, we certainly weren't going to offer anything concrete, and we didn't think Senator Clinton would either. So it was – what was interesting is the Edwards campaign at that point said, you know, they didn't think we could win South Carolina without Edwards' support. And it was interesting. It was a very fundamental misreading of how the South Carolina primary was going to unfold.
Let me ask you something that's a little off topic here. John Corsi, who was one of the leaders of the Swift Boat campaign during the Kerry campaign, he went to, I guess it was it Kenya, and tried to dig up information that it could be used against Barack Obama, and he found that Barack Obama had a half brother who was very poor. And he tried to make that seem as if it showed Barack Obama's lack of regard for his own family. And I'm wondering, how did that play inside the Obama campaign? You don't discuss this in the book, but I'm really curious.
I don't think we paid a moment of attention to it. I mean, I think it was preposterous. And, you know, I think...
What was preposterous?
Well, the whole notion, you know, that somehow, you know, this reflected poorly on his character. I think the Republican, sort of that wing of the Republican Party, you know, was so committed to trying to destroy his character. And I think, you know, what's interesting about a presidential campaign is it's a very transparent affair. Voters take your full measure. You really can't hide who you are. And so we didn't get worried about things like that because we didn't think voters would. You know, I think a lot of times people in politics make the mistake of doing these kind of inflammatory things because they can get press attention without thinking first about how are voters going to receive this information. And I think one thing we did well in the campaign is we always keep very focused on voters and the people. You know, what message are we sending to them? And we trusted them. We thought that they were ready to have a serious discussion about serious issues. And they were. And I think the other side, you know, when the McCain campaign ran ads saying that, you know, Barack Obama is an empty celebrity like Paris Hilton and Britney Spears, people didn't have a lot of tolerance for that. You know, there was plenty of people who said, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to vote for Obama. I've got problems with him. I disagree with him on issues. But the notion that he's, you know, an empty celebrity like these starlets, it was insulting to people.
You focus grouped that, didn't you, that campaign, to see how people would respond, the celebrity campaign?
Yeah, and the media was all, you know, lathering up, thinking it was a great idea by the McCain campaign, and it wasn't working. There were many times during the campaign where, you know, we were seeing the campaign through a different set of eyes than the media was. And I do think the media tends to get really taken by these ads, you know, that are kind of really over the top. The media tends to view things through the prism of the last race. Oh, Swift voting worked last time, it's going to work this time. And I think one of the reasons we, you know, were successful is, you know, we had a blank sheet of paper. And we studied history, but we were not bound by it. And I think that made us a very strong and effective campaign.
Now, you write that you expected Hillary Clinton to concede in Minneapolis because you were confident you had the numbers. And as you're expecting her to concede, and as Barack Obama is preparing to make a speech saying that he's going to be the candidate, Terry McAuliffe, her campaign chair, introduces her as the next president of the United States. Your reaction?
Well, we were dumbfounded because it wasn't our belief that we had won. We had been declared the winner by every television network and every newspaper. So it was like we were living in a parallel universe. But, you know, within 3 or 4 days, she did concede. And, you know, I think if you look at our campaign, you know, that was a year and a half contest. It was brutal. It was tough. It was close. And, you know, she didn't take 2 or 3 months to kind of get her arms around helping us. She helped us right away. And in profound and important ways. And I think it speaks really highly of her character that she so quickly said, you know, the stakes of this election are so high, we can't afford more of the Bush agenda. That's what McCain's offering. And so, yeah, that was a night where, you know, we were unhappy, obviously, that it seemed to be that reality wasn't acknowledged. But what's important in the long view is that it was quickly acknowledged. And, you know, she became a huge asset in the campaign.
She insisted on a meeting before conceding. What happened behind the scenes? What were you negotiating about?
Well, I think the meeting was both of us wanted to do it. Obviously, the two principals needed to come together and talk about how we were going to move forward. And, you know, for the most part, negotiations over the convention and hiring some of her staff and trying to get her volunteers involved in our campaign all went very, very well. Obviously, she was carrying a debt, and so there was some discussion about how to help with that. And we did what we could, probably not as much as they would have liked, but it's a hard thing to do to raise money to erase someone's debt while you're still trying to run a presidential campaign. But the negotiations after what we went through, again, you know, kind of looking over the sides of the DMZ for 18 months, went swimmingly well. You know, 95% of the things in our first conversation were taken care of. And their approach was basically, it was tough, but you guys won, and we cannot allow the Republicans to be in control of the presidency for another 4 years. So we're going to do all we can. And her motivation there was very pure. You know, it was not about what was in it for her. It was all about, you know,
she didn't ask for a position. She didn't say, and in return, I want to be
not
vice presidential candidate, Secretary of State, Supreme Court Justice.
No. And I was impressed by that. I really think her motivation here was that Barack Obama, his view of the world, his approach to domestic issues was so far superior to what McCain would do that she just wanted to do all she could to win. It was very impressive. And in fact, you know, when we were getting pressured by some of her supporters to pick her for VP, you know, she went in there very effectively and said, wait a minute, this is his decision, his alone. We shouldn't put any pressure on him. And I think that's, again, because she understands, you know, given what she went through with President Clinton, that, you know, someone like Barack Obama needed the time and space and atmosphere to make what he believed to be the right decision.
So Barack Obama is president now. What are you doing?
Well, I wrote the book. I spent a lot of this year writing the book, and I'm going to spend, you know, the next year spending a lot of time with my family. And, you know.
And how come you're not in the administration?
Well, strictly for personal reasons. You know, I have young family.
You had a baby born like 2 days after the election?
2 days after the election.
That's amazing.
So, you know, in these things, whether it be a campaign or the White House, you know, you're all in. There is no shortcuts. And after 2 years of the campaign, we needed a couple years to rebalance our lives. And, you know, what I told the president is obviously down the road, if he needs my help, I'll be ready in a couple years. But he's got a remarkable team doing remarkable work, and I'm proud to know them and think they're doing great work for America.
David Plouffe, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks for having me on.
David Plouffe was Barack Obama's campaign manager. His new memoir is called The Audacity to Win. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that my guest Jane Lynch co-stars on the Fox TV series Glee as the coach of the cheerleading squad, she's starting to get the recognition she deserves. Before Glee, she was best known for her comic performances in the mockumentary Best in Show and The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and her roles in The L Word, Julie and Julia, and the Starz TV series Party Down. Glee premiered last May after the season finale of American Idol and started its first season in September. Glee is about a high school teacher trying to put together a winning Glee club with a group of students who are mostly losers. The Glee club coach tries to be sensitive to the needs and insecurities of his students, but the cheerleading coach, played by Lynch, is mean to her girls and never satisfied with their performance. She sees the Glee club as her rival and eventually even tries to take it over. Here she is confronting the Glee club coach, played by Matthew Morrison.
So I had a little chat with Principal Figgins, and he said that if your group doesn't place at regionals, he's cutting the program. Ouch.
You know, you don't have to worry about Glee Club. We're going to be fine.
Really? Because I was at the local library where I read Cheerleading Today aloud to blind geriatrics. I came across this little page turner, the show choir rule book. And it turns out you need 12 kids to qualify for regionals. Last time I looked at you, only had 5.5. Here, cripple in the wheelchair. I also took the liberty of highlighting some special ed classes for you. Maybe you could find some recruits. Because I'm not sure there's anybody else who's going to want to swim over to your island of misfit toys.
Are you threatening me, Sue?
Threatening you? Oh, no, no, no. Presenting you with an opportunity to compromise yourself? You betcha.
Jane Lynch, welcome to Fresh Air. I want you to describe your character in Glee.
Well, she's kind of that inner mean girl that a lot of us have, that she's kind of right out in front. She doesn't have a filter. She doesn't have that socially acceptable way that we, you know, put how we might really feel. We'll put them into terms that, you know, are softer than what Sue would do. She's kind of right out there, and she takes great delight in her heinousness and her political incorrectness. And so that's where she gets her glee from.
Now, you've almost developed a catchphrase. You think that's hard, try, fill in the blank. What have been your favorite you think that's hard retorts?
My favorite one was, you think this is hard, try launching a fall show in May. That's hard. We did that for a promo. But the first one I came up with was the waterboarding one. If you think this is hard, try being waterboarded. That's hard. And then Ian Brennan, our writer, came up with a ton more. And I think in the pilot I say, you think this is hard, I'm living with hepatitis. That's hard.
So you came up with the waterboarding one?
I did.
How did you come up with that? What was the context?
Well, the cheerleaders are in this pyramid, and their muscles are shaking, and I'm making them hold it, and I'm standing there with a stopwatch. And on my way to work that day, I was thinking, how can I mock them and shame them while they're in that horrible, stressful position? And I started thinking about stress positions, which is what they do. You know, that's part of torture. And then I thought, waterboarding is much harder than this.
How did you get the part in Glee as the cheerleading coach?
Ryan Murphy and I have been friends for a while. I did an episode of Popular back in 1999, and we had a great time together. And I hadn't seen him in, almost 10 years. And I was in Vancouver doing something else. I forget what it was. And I got the script from my agent. And I was already in a pilot that year. And my agent said, Ryan wants you to do this. And if you can't do it as a regular, you can do it as a guest star for the pilot, and then we'll see what happens. So I read it, and I loved it. One of the first things it says about Sue in the script is that she may or may not have posed for Penthouse, and she's using horse estrogen. So I was like, oh, my God, I must play this woman. And the other deal that I was a part of fell apart, and by the third or fourth episode, I was able to call myself a regular on Glee, and I was thrilled.
Will you ever get to sing on Glee?
I hope so, Terry. I hope so. I'm humming all the time on the set auditioning, but I hope so. I did get to dance, and I really have no business dancing, so I was a little shocked that was the first thing they gave me to do. I'm hoping that I get to sing, and we've got 9 more episodes to do, and I'm crossing my fingers.
Now, although your job isn't to sing on Glee. We did hear you sing in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. and I just want to play a scene from that film. And you manage the electronics store that Steve Carell and his friends work in.
Right.
And you've kind of gotten wind of the fact that he's still a virgin at the age of 40. And you think you can be helpful in changing the situation for him. And that's what you're about in this scene. So this is Jane Lynch and Steve Carell in a scene from The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
My goodness, Andy, you are a terrific salesman.
Oh, thank you.
Gosh, you really got it down.
Thanks.
Yeah, your numbers are good.
Thanks.
I'm going to put you out on the floor full time.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Good, we're going to get you the blue shirt and the tie.
Oh, right? Great. Thanks.
You know, Andy, I've been thinking about your problem. I think I might have a solution for you.
Hmm.
You ever heard of the term buddy?
It's what?
It's a special friend.
No, I haven't heard that term.
When I was a little girl, I developed early. By the time I was 14, I had this body you're looking at. Can you imagine that?
I don't want to, no.
Well, needless to say, a lot of male attention.
I bet, yes.
Especially from our Guatemalan gardener, Javier.
Okay.
You know, Javier, before he made passionate yet gentle love to me for the first time, he serenaded me with a beautiful old Guatemalan love song.
Really? That's sounds nice.
Cuando arreglan mi cuarto, no encuentro nada. ¿Dónde va con tanta prisa al partido de fútbol?
Okay.
Ooh, my goodness. I think we better get back to work.
Yeah, I better go back to work.
Yeah.
So, okay.
All right. So you mull it over.
All right, I will. Thank you.
My guest, Jane Lynch, with Steve Carell in a scene from The 40-Year-Old Virgin. I love that scene, especially when you sing the song that the gardeners serenaded you with.
Yeah.
So was that song in the script? Or
no, that me coming on to him wasn't in the script either, and I have Steve's wife, Nancy Walls, to thank for that. It was a man's part, and she said, Steve, you have too many men in your movie. You should audition Jane for this part, because I know them from Chicago. We were at Second City at the same time.
Oh.
And so in the audition, we came up with the idea that I would try to seduce him and offer to take away his virginity from him. But the song is actually from a Spanish class, excuse me, in high school. And it's a kind of a dialogue, and it has nothing to do with love. It's whenever I clean my room, I can't find anything. Where are you going with such haste to a football game?
I thought I heard football at the end there.
Yeah, right. And I was just sitting around waiting to do waiting to work, and I started to think maybe I'll serenade him, and I came up with that. And I told Steve before we started, I said, I'm going to sing a little song. And he said, okay.
Did you intentionally sing a song that has nothing to do with romance?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Have people noticed it? Have people who speak Spanish noticed that?
Yeah, a lot of people, I guess my pronunciation is terrible. Even people who speak Spanish don't understand it. And also, I was taught Spanish by a woman, by a Cuban woman. So their V's are always B. So when I say donde va, I say donde va. And that threw people off completely. They didn't know what I was talking about.
Now, you got what I think was your big break in movies in the mockumentary Best in Show about people who bring their purebred dogs to compete in a dog show. And you play a trainer who's working with a standard poodle, and the owner's trophy wife, his over the hill,
right?
and a trophy wife who's had like a lot of cosmetic surgery has become your significant other,
right?
And so, here's a scene from Best in Show, in which you're basically talking to the camera with the trophy wife who has become very close to you.
With Sherry Ann, we have this fantastic friendship, too. It's really great. And we have a little bit of a family dynamic going here, and it pretty much mirrors what I grew up with, you know. My my father was the taskmaster, the disciplinarian, which is what I do. I'm the mommy slash daddy. That's right.
Like Mr. Punishment.
Oh, well, you know, and also reward. Mm. But Sherry's responsible for the unconditional love, you know.
And the decorative abilities.
Exactly, the heart and the soul, you know, which is what my mother did, and that was her job. You know, she was there for the unconditional love. Mm. And it worked for my family, you know, until my mom committed suicide in 81.
My guest, Jane Lynch, in a scene from Best in Show. Was that improvised?
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, I remember I was riding in the van on the way to the location, and that's when I thought of that, about the suicide thing, yes.
Now, Best in Show is directed by Christopher Guest. How did you meet him?
I was doing a commercial for Kellogg's Frosted Flakes, and he directed it. I did a lot of commercials, like in the, you know, the 90s in Los Angeles, and I got lucky enough to get into one of his. And he directs commercials all the time. He loves doing that, and we did it a la Guffman, Waiting for Guffman. It was improvised and everything. And then about 3 months later, I ran into him at a restaurant, and he was in the process of casting Best in Show. And, you know, he said, hey, come to my office today. And, you know, by the end of the day, I was, you know, had plans to go to Vancouver to shoot this. And I was thrilled because when I saw Waiting for Guffman, I about fell out of my seat and, you know, and down on my knees, please, please let me work this way. This is how I want to work. This is the way to do it. And this guy's got it down. So it was really a dream come true, a ridiculous, preposterous dream come true.
So what was the Frosted Flakes commercial like?
We were stalking Tony the Tiger. Myself and my husband were standing out in Battle Creek, Michigan. Of course, we shot in Los Angeles, but it was in Battle Creek, Michigan, waiting for Tony to go by. It wasn't a very successful campaign, but but it was fun to do.
And what other commercials did you do?
I'm best known, Terry, for my work in the Nexium commercial, where I'm standing on a cliff saying, I am every woman who's ever suffered from acid reflux. And I stopped it before it destroyed the lining of my esophagus. So I'm best known for that.
I always wonder if you worry if you do a commercial like that, that people will see you and think, acid reflux. What a tragedy, you know.
And then associate my face with it. You know,
exactly.
I'm so happy to have the job and to be able to pay my rent that month. You know, it's you know, people say, why did you do why did you do that stint on Married with Children? I was like, I jumped up and down when I got that job. That paid my rent.
One more question about Best in Show. There's a line that's really funny. This is like 6 months after the dog show, and you and the Jennifer Coolidge character are a genuine couple now.
Right.
And you're talking about how you founded a magazine called American Bitch, the magazine for lesbian dog owners, and there's a couple of mock-ups of the cover behind you. Was that yours, that line?
No. Chris came up with that. That was Chris Guest's invention, the American Bitch magazine.
I'm sure people repeat that to you all the time.
They do. People come up to me all the time. And, you know, I forget about it, and someone will say, you know, I subscribe to American Bitch. And I'm like, oh, and I'm wondering what they're talking. And then I remember, oh, yes, of course.
Now, since you played a lesbian in Best in Show, did people – and that since that was the movie that people really noticed you in terms of movies?
Yeah.
So did people assume that you were a lesbian because you played one?
No, not at all. No, I don't, you know, I don't think so. I don't think that happens so much. I think you can play a character and people don't confuse you that perhaps you're that way in real life. I mean, nobody asked Jennifer Coolidge if she was one either, I don't think.
But in this case, you are.
But in this case, I am, yeah.
So was it a kind of inadvertent coming out for you? Were you already out in the industry?
Well, I wasn't really known in the industry before Best in Show, and I didn't think twice about portraying a lesbian. Again, I jumped up and down when I got that job. Yeah, you know what? I didn't think too much about that at all. I never hid who I was. I also didn't lead with it. I don't feel like the need to walk into a room and say, you know, as a gay person, I need to have this, this, and this. So it, And nobody really seemed to care. And if I lost work or if I lost opportunities because I was gay, it happened behind my back and I didn't know about it. I've had it really easy. You know, it's been just very accepted and nobody seems to care.
You said that you had your first gay relationship when you were 20, but it took 11 or 12 years to actually come out to your family.
Right.
Were you out to yourself before you turned 20?
Yes. Yeah, it was reluctant. It was the last thing in the world I wanted to deal with. It was the last thing in the world I wanted to be. I'm one of those people who like to toe the line. I don't, as much as I, you know, love being an actress, I don't like calling attention to myself in that way. I don't want to be different. I'm not a rebel. I just want to be like everybody else. So it was a, you know, kind of a reluctant realization and a, oh, God, really? <You know? laughs> So, yeah, and it took me, you know, I think if I came out to my parents when I was 18, it would have been a different story. It might have been harder. But when I was 31 and finally came out, via a letter I wrote them, it was great. It was wonderful because we were starting to be estranged to each other because they didn't know about a very fundamental part of who I was. And so it was a good thing, and there was no drama around it. It was really kind of a lovely moment where we all came together and said, you know, oh, of course this doesn't mean anything, you know, and we still love you. And it was, you know, it was actually a wonderful, wonderful moment.
Why were you uncomfortable telling them for 11 years?
I think it was my own homophobia, my own internalized homophobia. You know, I didn't want to be gay. I wanted to be I wanted an easy life. And you know what? I am gay and I still have an easy life. So anybody out there who is afraid like I was, just know that there's, you know, come to Los Angeles or Chicago or New York and people will love you. It's no big deal.
Why did you write a letter to your parents instead of telling them in person?
Well, I went to a therapist, and this is a ruse that therapists get away with all the time. They say, write a letter and you don't have to send it. And usually you with, you know, having that pressure off of you, the letter was quite good, quite honest. And I was very proud of it. And I felt like I explained myself very well and how I was feeling. And then she said, you know, it's up to you if you want to drop it in the mail. And I did. Dropped it in the mail.
Did you feel like that was a courtesy in a way, writing a letter, because that way your parents didn't have to react with you in the room? They could kind
yes.
of think
oh,
it
absolutely.
Over and think of what mm-hmm. they wanted to say, not be like on the spot or shocked. And
exactly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I could have gone eye to eye and had this confrontation. That would have been very difficult. It would have, you know, probably been the very courageous way to do it. It would have been the brave thing to do. But, you know, I didn't have that much courage around it. And writing a letter was easier.
You know, it's so interesting to think of you not having the courage to talk to your parents, because every character you've ever played that I've seen has such chutzpah.
I know.
You know. Particularly your character in Glee. But that's right. One of the things that you do on screen in the roles that I know. Mm-hmm. Is you're really out there.
I kind of walk through the world presenting myself as that person. But I'm, and that's why I like playing that kind of person, because I don't feel – I don't have that much confidence. I don't have that much sexual confidence that a lot of my characters have. I don't have that much confidence to walk into a room and kind of announce who I am and shame everybody else around me. Not that that's a good kind of confidence to have, but I'm fascinated by people who are able to do that. And because I'm 6 feet tall, I do have a lot of physical energy. And when I walk into a room, people do kind of turn around and look. And I notice when I'm at a party, if I start to say something I think, you know, an opinion, the room kind of gets quiet. People listen, and I'm like, oh, my God, I'm making all this up. But there's something about I have kind of an authoritative energy, which I don't completely own, and I'm not completely confident in.
Was it helpful to you when Ellen DeGeneres came out on her show?
Yes. Yeah. I think it was helpful for all of us, and I think that's one of the reasons that I walked such an easy path. She, you know, blazed it for us, and I know she was kind of reluctant to do that too. I think it was a big deal when she came out. And it really kind of, you know, it rocked the world. And, I mean, look where she is now. She's got this great show and all these Midwestern ladies are there dancing with her. I think it's a great thing that she did.
So at what phase of your career were you in when Ellen came out?
I was doing voiceovers and commercials. You know, I was just a work-a-day actor making a nice living and, you know, nobody knew my name type of place. You know, I hadn't done Best in Show yet.
Voiceovers, what were you doing?
I did a lot of commercial voiceovers. I did, you know, for like Safeway, I did announcer copy, and then I would do stuff for radio, you know, with a partner reads, as we call them. I made my living in voiceover for about 5 or 6 years, and I would do the occasional on-camera commercial or the occasional guest spot on a sitcom. But mostly I was making my living as a voiceover person. I loved it. It's a great gig. It's a great job.
So what kind of characters were you supposed to represent?
I kind of have a stock old lady voice. I have kind of a stock Midwestern mom voice.
Can you give us a taste of them?
Yeah. Make sure you put some tomatoes on the sandwich. That's kind of a salsa. And then I always did this with my voice, kind of like a kind of an old lady kind of thing. And I use it even I repeat it even in when I do guest spots on sitcoms. I have like 2 tricks, Terry, and I just roll them out.
Now, you grew up in a suburb of Chicago. How did you know you wanted to act?
I think I was born wanting to act. There wasn't anything in my environment that inspired me. I was in kind of a typical Midwestern Irish Catholic family, and it's not like we were doing we weren't a show business family or anything like that. I was addicted to television. I knew I wanted to act in television. And then when we started doing pageants and plays in school, I loved doing that. And I knew that's what I wanted to do.
What TV shows were you addicted to?
The Brady Bunch was the big one.
Oh, you got to do a parody of the Brady Bunch.
Yeah, right, the stage show.
City.
So that was, that was fun. The real live Brady Bunch. And I played Carol Brady in that. And, everyone who was in that show with me in Chicago, we were all raised on the Brady Bunch and we were all obsessed with the Brady Bunch. And so it was really fun and cathartic for us to act that out.
What was most cathartic about it for you?
Well, it had this kind of sappy, very overly sentimental and really bad comedic combination, And even at the time when I was watching it, I knew it wasn't great television. I knew it wasn't a great comedy, but it was soothing. And it had this wonderful family where if you threw a little temper tantrum and you ran up into your room, a second later, there'd be a soft knock on your door. You want to talk? That was just very soothing. And we all found, here we were like 25 years old and talking about it going, I was a fan of it too. And it was kind of, you didn't want to admit that maybe you watched the Brady Bunch and were still addicted to it. So it was really exciting to put it on stage and actually, act that out and do the sappy comedy and do the over-sentimentalized stuff. It was really fun.
So
it was a real high point.
So as we record this, Glee has been renewed, is that the word, for another 9 episodes, but you're not...
We've been picked up for the back 9 is the technical term.
Thank you. but you're not shooting right now. So
no.
What do you do? So many actors are in this position. What do you do in that downtime when your career's going really well, you've got a great role, but you've got this kind of down period where you're not actually working? What do you do with your time?
Well, I'm in New York right now doing a staged reading of a Nora and Delia Ephron play called Love, Loss, and What I Wore. So I'm here for a month doing that.
Oh.
And I'm busy all day long doing press for Glee and press for that. I have been I've been crazy busy, more busy than I've ever been before in between jobs. But those times in between jobs in the past – I would start some more voiceover work. I'd start out, auditioning for voiceover stuff. I'd just try to keep myself busy. I go to lunch a lot. I drink a lot of coffee. I'm very social when I'm, and it just turns out that, errands and everything else, you end up filling the day. I very rarely am sitting around going, oh, my God, what am I going to do with myself?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Jane Lynch, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
I wish you continued success.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Jane Lynch co-stars in the Fox TV series Glee as the mean-spirited coach of the cheerleading squad called the Cheerios. Here she is in a scene in the teacher's lounge where she's just surprised some of the faculty by bringing them lattes.
What's with all the lattes?
Oh, Emma, I just felt so awful that Figgins cut the coffee budget to pay for a nutritionist for the Cheerios.
Yeah, I heard you guys went like $600 over budget on that.
My performers didn't get on Fox Sportsnet last year because they ate at Bacon Junction.
Since when are cheerleaders performers?
Your resentment is delicious.